continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. This is Jams. Joining me in studio,
Victoria Grant.
And
Adrian Griffin Law.
And we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization,
Personality studies.
Yes, yes. Environmental racism.
Love, parenthood, identity.
Yeah. And we try to get a reasoning going every Saturday. And then from 4 to 5, the DJs bring you music to move you. I got to give a big shout out, sending lots of love to a few of our members who are not here today. Mm-hmm. Enough love to Kemba King, to Melinda and Luam. Everybody is away on assignment today. So sending them out some love. But today is really kind of a special show. I've been looking forward to this for a while. We have live in studio with us Leanne Patamasapit. I always say it right, but now that I'm on the air, let me do it. Patasamasak Simpson, who is an Indigenous author, writer, speaker, thinker, philosopher, and all-around awesome person. Welcome to the Vibe Collective. Welcome back to the Vibe Collective.
Ani, thank you.
Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
We also have live on the phone with us, straight from Vancouver, Jarrett Martineau. Jarrett Martineau is also a scholar, a writer, and an organizer, and one of the founders of the Indigenous Nationhood Movement. Jarrett, welcome to the Vibe Collective.
Tanse, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You're both here to talk about Indigenous Nationhood Movement. We're going to talk a little bit about some of your work, Leanne, and your work, Jarrett. We're also going to get into some discussion around solidarity and the intersections of this movement and how, you know, the roots are kind of spreading and the directions that it's going in. So in case anybody isn't familiar, Indigenous Nationhood Movement launched a website, Nations Rising, about a month ago now, I guess it was. Is that correct, Jarrett?
Yeah, I think coming up on 3 weeks. Yeah, next week might be the first month, yeah.
Yeah, and nationsrising.org is the website. And if people go to the website, they will see your statement of principles, and it's available in, is it 14 or 15 different languages?
It's up to 15 now. We have more coming.
So do you want to talk a little bit about the statement of principles and why you have it translated into so many different languages, Jarrett?
Let's see. Well, I mean, the starting point is that the Statement of Principles itself was a collaborative document that was written by people from a number of different nations to begin with. And as it was becoming formed by all of the different voices and perspectives that kind of went into putting it together, in part connected to the Indigenous Leadership Forum that we held back in May, I guess, at the University of Victoria, which also had people from all over Turtle Island. We recognized kind of right at the outset that we wanted to make what we were doing as accessible as possible, both in terms of Indigenous languages, but then also communities in solidarity and in alliance, because we've always saw this, what we're doing as an extension of activism that's gone on from a long time ago, but also that branches out and does extend all four directions beyond just the Indigenous nations that are a part of the movement directly.
Right, and Leanne, when we spoke with you on Indigenous Waves, you talked about the fact that this movement is very ancient. It's been happening for a long, long time. Our ancestors have been carrying it forward. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what that means?
Well, I think over the last 10 years, I've thought a lot about what nationhood means to me, and I think it means something very different than when maybe Canadians say nationhood. And so I've spent a lot of time talking to elders and trying to figure out for myself in a really personal way what Anishinaabek nationhood might look like. And what I think I've come to understand is that the things that my ancestors wanted for me back in the late 1700s and early 1800s when they were making treaties with the settlers is really the same things that I want for my great-grandchildren. I want them to have a homeland. I want them to know their history. I want them to know their culture. I want them to be able to have an intimate relationship with the land. And so I think that those are the things that really unite me with other citizens of Indigenous nations all over Turtle Island and all over the world. And so I see this work really as an extension of what my ancestors were doing several generations ago.
And you wrote about that on the Nations Rising blog and the piece, the incredible piece you wrote, I Am Not a Nation State. There were so many things in that piece that resonated. And what you're talking about right now, what you want for your grandchildren, and you know the basic things that you know we should all have access to: clean water, fresh air, and then something else that you wrote about that has really resonated is the ability to access the land beyond the land without being harassed by settlers. And, you know, whether it's for ceremony or for just interacting with the land. Can you talk a little bit about that in particular, what it means to be attempting to have that relationship with the land, but then, you know, having the interference of settlers?
Well, I'm Mississauga Anishinaabek, and our territory is roughly the north shore of Lake Ontario. And so, you know, that area is an area that's experienced pretty intense colonialism and colonization over several centuries now. And so for us to be out on our land doing things that I think Canadians take for granted, like having a ceremony or visiting a sacred site or visiting a home that maybe your great-grandparents, a place where your great-grandparents lived, things like that, oftentimes we get very harassed and experience a lot of racism doing those things, practicing our culture, hunting and fishing and collecting medicines. And so for me, I think it's really, really important that we start to have that discussion. And I think that that's a discussion that's happening in a lot of different Indigenous communities and a lot of urban places. And I think these ideas around culture and land and language are something that Indigenous people really hold in common. And I think sometimes where we disagree is on strategy. But to me, that's a pretty minor thing, because we're fighting for something that's really, really big. And I tend to focus on those areas of overlap with different movements and different organizations, because I think that that what we're fighting for is our survival as Indigenous peoples in our homeland. And I think that's really, really important.
Definitely. I want to talk a little bit about that because, you know, we're coming up on the anniversary of Idle No More. And the, you know, the culmination of that as a movement, and the ways in which that, you know, the whether or not people take issue with the word idle, A lot of people did take issue with that because a lot of people say, you know, we haven't been idle. We've been resisting all along. But the movement itself certainly, I think, breathed a lot of life into creating a sort of an umbrella for people to mobilize underneath. And I know that Indigenous Nationhood Movement is distinguishing itself through a different sort of strategy. So maybe, I don't know if Leanne, you can speak with that to that, and then Jared, I would like to hear from you as well, because you know we have a lot of different opinions about this happening and the sort of two different movements.
Yeah, I think Idle No More last winter was an incredible, profound, amazing movement for our community in general, and I think the Toronto organizers were amazing. They did event after event, reaching out to all different kinds of communities. The events were well organized. They brought in people. They recognized leaders within this community. They talked about nationhood. They talked about mobilization. And I feel like at the events that I was at here, there was this real sense of unity, but there was also, we were also having critical discussions in a way that I think is really respectful and was honoring of each other. And I think the Indigenous Nationhood Movement, because I feel like I've been involved with building nations and resurgence for 10 or 15 years now, it's something that I've always felt in my heart was the way to go, because I think building up each other and our communities around connecting to the land, around language, understanding our philosophies and our politics on our own terms, within our own cultures, connecting with our elders, ceremony, all of those types of things are really, really critical for us right now. And it's how we sort of build nations from the inside out. And I see kind of in the future, I imagine, you know, what if we had sort of 60 or 70% of Indigenous people articulate in their own political traditions, knowing their language, knowing their ceremonies, connected to their land. What does that look like? That changes the landscape. That changes the political landscape in Canada in a pretty profound way. So I've always thought to myself that that's where I want to put my energy. So I think I don't see myself as a founder. I don't see myself as a leader. I don't see myself as any of that. I want to, in my work through the Indigenous Nationhood Movement, support other people like myself who are doing this work on the ground. And I want to be able to organize with other like-minded people to support that on-the-ground work. And I don't, I know that a lot of us are organizing under different sort of organizations and different banners, but I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of commonality, and I'd like there to be kind of a lot of mutual support across that difference. I don't know. Jarrett, do you have more to add?
Yeah, Jarrett, we'd like to hear some of your thoughts on the strategies, the difference of strategies, why Indigenous Nationhood Movement felt the need to distinguish itself in this way.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm wary of kind of the way that some of these conversations get framed in terms of competitiveness over certain spaces of political articulation. And I would really echo Leanne's point about trying to create momentum and forms of support for this kind of work that's being done across many different communities and by many different people. And that really, if you go back to all of what was happening during the time of Idle No More from this past winter, a lot of those conversations were about what we've been talking about, were about nationhood. So to me, like, a lot of this is really the natural kind of outgrowth of all of the energy and all of the kind of sparks and fires that were lit over the course of this past winter as a way of carrying momentum and kind of carrying organizing energy forward. And that, I think, very much from my perspective in terms of being involved with what we're doing now, I would echo Leanne's point as well. I mean, I don't think that anybody that's been involved in what's been happening with the Nationhood Movement, with Nations Rising, the different voices that are represented on the site, and the Statement of Principles, to me, is a kind of organizing framework for this. Is like, we're trying to find new ways, new forms, new processes to support this work happening in our communities. And it's about the re-strengthening of our nations, which is about the re-strengthening of our communities, which is about the families, which is about the individuals. And so working from that place from the inside out, and then at the same time recognizing that there's a kind of outward-facing, public-interfacing part of this, which, you know, is taken up to some extent by what we've been doing through the website and what other groups are doing as well, is finding this way to kind of navigate these new spaces of political engagement. And that's a process of continual recreation. And so to me, the more ideas we have that are involved in that work, the more people, the more members of our nations and our communities that are involved in that work, the better. And we need to find all of those kind of different forms and ways of thinking about this creatively in order to make some of those substantial political changes. And I would also say that it's part of the reason why our focus isn't strictly, and I'm not saying that Idle No More is strictly focused on this, but it was a big point of kind of contention and focus back through the winter, which was around an explicit focus on strictly the kind of legislative actions that were being taken by the Harper government. And a lot of the conversations that came out of that winter were about, okay, well, what's beyond that? What's beyond C-45? What's beyond just looking at this particular administration at a federal government? What about our global interconnected struggles as indigenous peoples fighting for these fundamental principles of land, life, water? You know, like, these things are really essential to who we are and to the kind of continued survival and regeneration of our nations, and we need to find ways to work together across a much wider spectrum, I think, than we have been.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would agree with that. I think those are all really important and valid points, especially regarding the going beyond the legislation. However, you know, the fact of the matter is there is this suite of legislation that, you know, is attacking Indigenous people. The latest is, of course, the First Nation Education Act. But, you know, what's happening in El Sapuktuk right now, what's happening in at Barrier Lake, it's just like it's an attack from every direction. So I don't think we can ignore the legislation either.
Absolutely not.
And then I'm also curious. I agree with you that, you know, it's, unfortunately, the mainstream doesn't know how to dialogue about Indigenous issues, especially if we don't all agree, right? It's like, then suddenly we're no longer valid, or the issue is no longer valid. And certainly we shouldn't all agree. We've got, you know, all these different nations across a vast piece of land, different cultures, language, relationships to the land. But what you have are a lot of grassroots people who are trying to figure this out. I see this on Twitter. I see it on Facebook. I see people dialoguing about Idle No More, Indigenous Nationhood Movement. And then there's a lot of, like, I think, people trying to navigate this in-between space. So I'm curious, Jared, I'd like to hear from you. And then, Leanne, I'd like to hear from you as well. I'm curious about what your thoughts are about that, those people who are, you know, sort of in between, in this in between, they see some unity with the movements, but they also see some contention with the movements, and there's a lot of discussion about that. And I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I mean, you know, I've been saying this since I was involved in a lot of the Idle No More stuff back in the winter, and I've been saying this all the way through that process, because the same kind of accusations were being leveled at us from mainstream media, from federal politicians, from some of our own Indian Act leadership in various capacities about decrying the lack of unity, calling for unity as uniformity and all these things. And I've been saying all the way through that, and I'm still saying now, you know, a diverse set of perspectives and opinions are reflective of our diversity as nations and as autonomous individual people and as communities and so on. So for me, healthy dialogue and discussion is a great thing and is necessary and is important, and we need to be having those conversations. I think, you know, I can speak certainly for myself, but I think you all know too, social media has a particular way of generating very specific forms of kind of engagement that often lead to, as you can see even say on the comment sections on most mainstream news sources, a very different kind of conversation than you would necessarily have face-to-face or in other forms of kind of gathering and engagement. So I think in thinking through the way that people are engaging some of these questions, we also need to look at how those conversations are deepening and going on outside of strictly the social media sphere, because that's one particular set of perspectives, and that's one particular form of kind of conversation and engagement that's been happening. I think one of the ways in which we've been trying to kind of open up space for more dialogue and discussion in hopefully a constructive way, and also a way that invites a really broad range of perspectives, has been through the blog that we started with Nations Rising, and that has been, we put out an open call for contributions, so people that want to write for the blog or want to submit some writing, you know, are welcome to do that. And we've also been getting lots of different people trying to extend these conversations because they are going on in lots of different spaces. And this is, part of the work is figuring out a way that we can do that that's constructive, and that people feel like their own engagement and understanding is enhanced by virtue of engaging it, as opposed to feeling like they're going to be further marginalized or further divided. Because frankly, you know, that's the way a lot of these things can go on the internet, but that's the internet.
Yes, Leanne.
Well, I think I see overlap in different movements through Out on the Moor and the Indigenous Nationhood movement and the new sort of treaty organization in the prairies. And I also see difference. And I feel like I don't see the need for contention. I see a need for difference, but not contention. And I think for people who are sort of watching this happen, I think the thing is to sort of read the website, read some of the blog posts, and also figure out where you are personally on this, and then look where your community is. What is your community willing to organize? We have a lot of overwhelming issues facing Indigenous people right now, whether you're on the reserve or whether you're urban. The missing and murdered Indigenous women, poverty, nation building, and then this host of legislation that's coming from the Harper government, which is just a continuation of a colonial government. So there's short-term things that need to be done, and there's long-term things that need to be done. And I think I really see a need for people to figure out where they can contribute in a positive way. And it doesn't actually matter to me where they're making that positive contribution, but it does matter to me that we are putting something into the circle instead of taking something out. It's really, really easy to sit back on Twitter and tear things down. And I don't know how that's positive given what we're facing. So I think for my own self, I think going away and doing that work and recognizing the community that I'm surrounded by on the ground in my real life and figuring out the conversations we're having and what we want to do on our land are really, really important work. And I think we also need to do, to not neglect our relationship building with each other. Because a lot of this takes place online and it doesn't take place face to face. And I think that if you look at a lot of the Indigenous movements of the past, our people did a lot of visiting. They did a lot of reaching out. There was a lot of tea drunk around kitchen tables. There was a lot of conversations around fires. And I worry a little bit about an online community because we're not doing that. We're not meeting each other face-to-face. We're not listening. And I think in terms of bringing about the kind of radical transformation we're talking about, we have to be able to sustain our movements over a long period of time. This isn't going to happen. The change we're looking for isn't going to happen over a few months or over one winter. We have to be able to sustain that level of pressure over several years to bring about the kind of change we're looking at. And in order to do that, we have to be very, very strong internally with each other. We have to do the work that builds strong families and strong communities so that when someone feels angry and starts to be destructive, that we have a community around that and we all don't fall apart. And I think that part has been missing with us for a few years, and it shows every time we get 2 months into something or 6 months into something and we collapse internally. And the colonizer knows that. And the outside media knows that. It's very, very easy to fan the flames of internal division right now. And we're smarter than that and we're better than that. And we have cultures and ceremony that are designed to prevent that.
Yeah, I think that's a really critical point and something that we see happening. I think everybody wants to see themselves reflected and not necessarily knowing how to take that first step to get themselves, outside of the online activism and into, even if they are involved in stuff on the ground, when people's images, representation, those things are so delicate, and people need to see themselves reflected. They need to see themselves represented. My observation has been that's what that internal collapse is about, is that people are trying to find their place in these movements, because they, I think everybody probably wants the same thing, for the most part, you know, with exception to people who are suffering from serious internalized colonization. But in terms of the movement, you know, but the mobility and that creating that space for everybody. It really is about a face-to-face, nation-to-nation, person-to-person relationship building. And that's sort of, I guess, the conundrum of our of this era, right? Of being in a technological era. We're going to have to take a very brief break, and then when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about Elsie Pukdok. You wrote a really great piece on that, Leanne. And then I also want to extend the conversation to talking about how other non-colonial settler nations can be a part of this movement, as you know, Canadians. Supporting Indigenous people in the Indigenous nationhood movement. I want to remind the listeners you're listening to The Vibe Collective, and we're going to take a very brief break. We'll be back after this message on CAUT 89.5 FM.
The evolution continues. CAUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we're back on the Vibe Collective, CAUT 89.5 FM. This is Jams. Joining me in studio,
Victoria Grant,
Adrian Griffin-Wall.
And we are speaking with Leanne Potasmasak-Simpson. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Yay. And on the line, we also have Jarrett Martineau. And we are speaking with Jarrett and Leanne about the Indigenous Nationhood Movement, about Nations Rising, the blog, and also about diversity of strategies, of voices, of opinions. And I wanted to get into talking a little bit about Elsie Pukdok, because it's an ongoing issue that we can't not talk about. First of all, one of the main things we talk about every week on The Vibe Collective is environmental racism. That's exactly what we're seeing in Elsie Pukdok. But something that is really interesting, that we had Ozzie Michelin on Indigenous Waves last week, and what he said, which I thought was a really important point to make, is this is really different. What's happening in Elsie Pukdok is much different than anything we've ever seen before, because of the unity that's happening between Acadians and Mi'kmaq people, people who have historically been opposed over things like lobster rights and fishing rights. Because the one common thread is water. Yesterday, I believe there were 5 arrests. I believe they've all been released now, but the RCMP continues to wear masks and essentially stalk anybody who's anywhere near the SWN thumpers. And Leanne, you wrote a really amazing piece, again, on the Nations Rising blog about Elsie Pukdok and your experience there. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, when I was a master's student, I was at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick, and I was doing my research on juvenile Atlantic salmon on the Miramichi River. I was a biology student, and I was up and down Highway 11 quite a bit, and I met some people from, it was called Big Cove at the time. It was where I did my first sweat, and it's a place that I think emotionally I connect to, and I think what it's demonstrated to me and to Canadians is something that I think Indigenous people have known for a long time, but it's very, very difficult to stand up and say no to development, to extraction of natural resources on our territories, whether it's deforestation or mining or fracking. And I think over the last 5 years, it's become more difficult because the criminalization of dissent and protest has become much more intense. And so I think you're seeing, right, what we're seeing play out in Elsie Pukdok right now is that there's virtually no other way to stop the extraction other than placing bodies in front of those trucks. And in order to to do that successfully, you need a tremendous number of people willing to do that. And so I think it's demonstrated how things have changed because of changes in legislation and because of changes in how the state is dealing with this kind of protest and dissent. And it should be a huge wake-up call to Canadians because fracking just isn't happening in New Brunswick. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, but it's also been banned in a lot of places. There's a moratorium. Ontario just called one. Quebec has one along the St. Lawrence River. BC, they're in talks about having a moratorium at the Sacred Headwaters.
Also in the States, right? I can't remember which states, but I know several. I read that several states in the U.S. have said, you know, don't even think about it.
That's right. And France has a ban on it because it's so controversial and because it's so dangerous. And the cost effect, it's just not worth it. Victoria, did you have something you wanted to say?
No. I was, you're talking about the costs. You know, just reading about it on mainstream, when they talk about costs, all I've seen in articles was the cost to SWN, how much money they're losing per day as a result of these protests, how much money they're not able to gain as a result of. That's something that I'm constantly reading when I'm searching, you know, just Google El Sepaktuk, and you come up with the mainstream articles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a common thread.
Yeah, the narrative is constantly about economics. And that's, I think that's what's been informing all of this legislation that we see. It's this propaganda about, you know, Harper's economic plan. Meanwhile, you know, his economics are not that great. he's actually plummeting Canada deep into debt. But I want to get back to the interesting solidarity that we're seeing at El Sepaktuk, and I'm curious to know your thoughts. Jarrett, maybe we can hear from you about how you see non-colonial settlers as, you know, what the role is for non-colonial settlers in the Indigenous nationhood movement.
Well, I mean, let's see, there's a number of different ways to answer that question, I think. I mean, I think when there's specific things that are happening, like we've seen in El Sepaktuk, where there's possibilities for local communities to rally in more direct ways in support of action that's happening on the ground, then absolutely and fundamentally that's needed. And I think that we've seen really good evidence of that with El Sepaktuk in terms of the work that's being done there for other communities that have stepped up to really represent themselves alongside, you know, their Mi'kmaq brothers and sisters. I think that, you know, Leanne's piece speaks to this a little bit as well, which is the fact that El Sepaktuk is everywhere. These kinds of fights are happening in so many of our communities, and if they aren't already in the midst of happening, there's certainly, El Sepaktuk is a beacon of things to come. So I think, if anything, there's more opportunity than there ever has been as a result of all the movements that we've been seeing come about in our different communities for non-Indigenous people to really find those first points of entry, contact, and communication with Indigenous people and Indigenous communities that are doing work on the ground. And so the first point, and I think really central to what we're doing with the Nation of Movement, is trying to open up those pathways and those conversations so that more people can get in touch with each other. And I'm currently in New York City. I've been here since the end of August, and it's been fascinating for me to come out of the experience that I've had in Victoria, working with people on the West Coast there, getting to community and community work that's being done there, and to come to a new place, and a place as big as New York City, where the Indigenous population is next to invisible in terms of public consciousness, and these debates and dialogues aren't going on in the same way. But in the course of being here for a couple of months, all of the activists and organizers that I've met doing work across a variety of different communities and in a variety of different contexts have all been not only so receptive to what I've been talking about in terms of the work that we're doing within the Indigenous Nation of Movement, but have also been saying how much they're in support and in solidarity and how long our struggles have been interconnected. And so I think in a lot of ways what we're trying to do is like pick those pieces back up again and put people back into dialogue and conversation to recognize that we don't need to see necessarily these struggles between Indigenous claims to land, to water, to space, the political autonomy as necessarily exclusive of those lines of solidarity and support. And if anything, the strength is in the numbers. When these things go down, as Leanne said, you need bodies on the front lines. You know, we need to not be outpaced by the RCMP 10, 20 to 1. We need to be able to be strong in various big numbers. And so I think there's that kind of frontline on the ground work that we need that physical support, but there's also the kind of interconnections between our various forms of organizing that need to happen. And I think that's a big part of what we can help provide through the networks that we're building with the Nation Hub movement.
Yeah, Leanne, what are your thoughts on solidarity? Unity,
well,
and
you mentioned environmental racism, and I think that's a good point because oftentimes around the environment, there's a lot of people of colors, communities, indigenous communities that experience an asymmetric environmental degradation in an asymmetric way, and that's important. But I think another thing that I'm noticing is that in Canada, in general, Canadians are pretty okay with leaving the Indigenous population to deal with environmental issues. And so if fracking comes to your community, sometimes I feel like there's this people, the white people are crossing their fingers that the Anishinaabe are going to get mad and do something. And I feel a little bit resentful there because I feel like, you know, people are complaining about Harper, but I don't see any kind of large-scale mobilization of Canadians. And I think I've started to think kind of more, instead of solidarity and allyships, I've been thinking more about co-resistance and what does that look like and how do we sort of mobilize and start to embody some of these things that we're thinking about maybe in our heads, but actually taking a stand and being brave and speaking our minds and putting bodies on the line because I don't think it can just be Indigenous people. And I think that for me, at the end of the day, you know, Justin Trudeau or someone else is going to get elected. And I think that the system isn't going to change. So for me, I think my activism and my dissent has to be greater than Harper because you can't vote yourself out of colonialism. And that's where I think this nation building movement discussion is really, really important because it starts to reframe environmental issues and environmental degradation in a way that's consistent with the Indigenous experience of those issues that came with colonialism. And those are an attack on our great-grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in terms of building solidarity, it's easier to have those discussions with Canadians who are willing to stand up and do something to bring about the transformation that so many of us are talking about.
And I also think it's challenging some of the mainstream settler narratives of we're just trying to get ahead in this system without recognizing that there's a history here and there's been a history of resistance here that in some ways challenging them are part of the reason why we're here to kind of like take up this land that has been... well, you know, just kind of, in some sense, working along with the colonizers, in a sense, is like a lot of the reason why immigrants are here, mm-hmm. you know. And even though it's a complicated story and you have people working very hard within this system and focused on survival, etc., there's also this other piece we need to consider and think about how exactly it is we're going to co-resist or at least tell our stories in a way that continually makes space for these realities and hopefully futures of, you know, of co-resistance and if so be it allyship.
And I think that people are aware. Yesterday on my way to work, I was sitting beside a woman who is here via Congo. She's Congolese. She was flipping through the metro and there was a big ad, and it said it was paid for by the government of Ontario. And we had a discussion about it because she said, look at this. It says the province of Ontario, government of Ontario, is looking for people to discuss ways in which they can something or the other on their land. And she said to me, that's disgusting. This is not their land. This is Indigenous land. So I think people are aware of it, but maybe it's just an issue of where does she coming here via, you know, a country that's stricken by poverty, she was talking about her family as well, coming here to sort of, you know, work. She was telling me every week she sends back money back home. It is like being aware of what's going on, but how do you in turn, I guess, co-resist being solidarity, not being aware of just how to go about, you know, doing certain things. But I think people are aware, the settler class, they're aware.
Yeah. And I mean, to that point, you know, the genius, the evil genius of colonization is that it has capitalism to support it. That's sort of the fundamental pillar of colonization and how it's managed to spread so that people are so reliant on that, you know, having been removed from their natural selves, their natural ability to provide. Adrian and I were talking about this earlier, about in the Caribbean, pre-IMF and then post-IMF, and you had, you know, people who were able to sustain themselves, grow their food, fish, pick fruit, pick vegetables, and you know, survive on the land. Granted, it was, you know, colonized land, but, you know, there was still that sort of connection to the land. And then the IMF came into a lot of these countries and enforced
it? The SAP program.
Yeah. And
structural adjustment, and just kind of changed the entire economy. But there's also people who were very receptive to this because it was linked to their ideas of modernization and images they might have seen on television, etc. And this is how we're going to become more like these quote-unquote more civilized people. And so it was looked at as a kind of progress, but at the same time the trade-off was we're going to disrupt your connections to this land, etc. You know, and like, it's interesting, I think someone particularly from a place like Congo would clearly recognize this is indigenous struggle because they've gone through similar things in their country. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about is a very similar program that unfolds throughout the world and, you know, kind of facilitates these migrations of people, because people are leaving because either, you know, there's certain kinds of oppression there, a certain place in their local colonial society, and they're looking to go someplace else. Mm-hmm. And they're usually running from very similar circumstances and coming and kind of helping those same circumstances unfold in another place. Right. You know, and that's kind of like how you get the peopling of the North Americas and, you know, this kind of migration of people. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of times very similar, again, circumstances, but it doesn't, there seems to be a disconnect, and people often are, some people anywhere, often reluctant to see those similarities and their connections.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And then you have people like Charles Roach, who would refuse to take oath to the Queen. And so he never did get his citizenship. He just passed away about 6 months ago now, I think, or 7 months ago, or longer.
Yeah, was it April?
Okay. And he was on our show just before he passed. And he was an incredible organizer, educator, writer, poet in the Black community here in Toronto, originally from Trinidad, and refused to take that oath to the Queen because of the colonial nature of it. And you know, so there are people who are looking at these different ways of resisting, and I really like that reframing of it, of solidarity or allyship as co-resisting.
And it goes in cycles. I remember as a child, I might have been 4 or 5, going on First Nations land with a friend of my mother's, and we were fishing in, you know,
it's all First Nations land, but
thank you. specifically, you know, claimed, and people lived, you know, in that particular place, and then that was maybe, you know, in 1990s, and it kind of petered out. Like, if it was from the extent that Shimu had moved away, I don't know what became of her, and then my parents kind of, I guess, their politics changed in a way. And that was, I guess, 30 something years ago. And I know that there's been movements before, but it seems to be a sort of cycle. And I guess like most political movements as well. But there's a history of some connections, is what I'm trying to get at, between settlers such as myself and my family and First Nations groups. And hopefully we can regenerate those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's what I was trying to get at earlier, in saying that like there are very deep roots in the interconnections of our struggles, and we need to really go back and like recuperate those histories and understand that we're building on something that's gone before. It's not just sort of a new question about how do indigenous people work with settler people and to try to recreate this really strict kind of binary. There's a lot of people that understand in a very first-hand basis, like you're referring to, the experience of colonialism from another place, and are coming here not necessarily with the intention to reproduce that colonial relationship, with commitment to that same struggle in terms of trying to figure out, working in the land where they are now, how they can commit to an anti-colonial politics and a politics of resistance. Like, we have a lot to draw from, and I think that for me that's so essential to what we're doing with the Nation of Movement, is to really try to say, look, like, there's a lot to build on here, and we are interconnected in our work, and we have been interconnected in our work, and if we lost sight of that, let's help to refocus that. Let's draw on those lines of strength, and let's start to have those conversations. Let's be visiting each other in ways that we haven't been, because there's a tremendous amount of power. It's a really great opportunity to be coming around that cycle again.
Mm-hmm. And I think the urban environment is an excellent place to do that, because we both have a significant presence in the urban environment. I always get asked, you know, in terms of the Indigenous Nation movement, what can I do? I live in this city. This is the perfect thing. And I think there's so many opportunities in terms of connecting our youth across these communities of resistance. And there's so many opportunities in terms of building relationships through the arts. And I think the urban environment is it's ripe for that right now.
Certainly. Another history I remember was a Fresh Arts program. Right? Mm-hmm. Before it was Fresh Arts, it was Fresh Elements. I mean, I was, wow, that's a long time ago. And I was in that program, and you had a really concerted effort by the organizers. And one of the organizers, I remember her name was Mari Mumford, was to link, you know, urban black youth with, you know, First Nations people, Indigenous people. Mm. And so there were so many things that we did artistically that incorporated those things. Right, so just again highlighting that there is a history of these things. And everyone knows that, like, out of Fresh Arts, Fresh Elements came, like, Cardinal and Socrates, mm-hmm. and Julie Black and all these people collaborated in it. But it was, even then, it was at its root aspiring to connect these communities. And so there's a history of that here in Toronto and other places, I'm sure. And so, again, it's not something that's completely alien, but it's, again, it goes through these cycles, and it's great to see it coming back again.
Yeah. That's funny, because Mari Mumford lives in Peterborough now.
Oh, yeah.
And just last year she brought hip-hop and breakdancers from Toronto to meet with our kids as hoop dancers. And then they had this great, you know, cross-cultural collaborative exchange. And it was a great way to, they were all dancing to A Tribe Called Red. It was awesome.
That is awesome. And those are the kinds of connections we try to make here on the Vibe Collective. That's why we do the show we do every Saturday, because we see those intersections. We see them as places of strength and places to build on for co-resistance, because there are so many similar sort of struggles that we're faced with as marginalized peoples under colonial oppression. Certainly there are very unique and specific issues as well, but that's one of the reasons why we have this dialogue every Saturday, because we're trying to make those connections and trying to build understanding and bridges, you know, with our communities.
I think it's really though the singing and the dancing and the food. And it's those things, those good things about all of our cultures across those communities that sustain movements and that heal us and that enable us to go and stand up and continue the fight. And so I think that work is really, really important as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as what you were saying before, you know, about having a face-to-face relationship rather than online relationship. And I have a 16-year-old daughter, and the way in which she interacts with her friends is so different from how, you know, our generation did, you know, spending hours on the phone, hanging out face-to-face. I mean, you know, they still hang out face-to-face, but they don't talk on the phone anymore. It's all texting and connecting in social media platforms. And to me, that's a really interesting sort of shift in how people are, you know, communicating. I think there's some great things that can happen from those social media spaces. Connections can be made that we couldn't make before. But what you're saying is so true. We have to have that time. We have to have time where we're sharing food, where we're just, you know, visiting, where we're not talking about politics, or we're sharing ceremony or sharing song and dance. Those things are really, really critical as well.
I think why we all last winter were able to capitalize on social media to such a degree in terms of our organizing is because Indigenous people already had face-to-face networks set up. Mm-hmm. And so we already knew each other. Or if I didn't know the person that was organizing in Alberta, you know, my cousin's friend did. And so we were able to, over a short period of time, develop this online community of trust based on our on-the-ground relationships. And I think in order to sustain that, we have to go back to those on-the-ground relationships and make sure they're strong.
Mm-hmm. We only have about 10 minutes left in the show, and I'd like to hear from both you, Leanne, and you, Jarrett. What your thoughts are? We are certainly in a state of emergency. There's no question about that in terms of Indigenous people being under attack from the Canadian government. There's a suite of legislation. It's not just Bill C-45, Bill C-38. The Senate, there's a suite of Senate bills as well that are attacking, you know, water, attacking rights through the Indian Act, making changes without consultation, and then all of the resource extraction, the Education Act. Like, it's just coming from every direction. So what would you like to see happen with Indigenous nationhood movement? Leanne, you mentioned that it's not going to take place over the course of a winter. It's going to take a few years. What would you like to see in terms of the diverse strategies coming from communities, grassroots communities, Indigenous communities in this resistance movement?
I think that Indigenous people need to control the agenda, and I think we need to set the agenda ourselves, because when we perceive that we're under attack, and, you know, it is intensified a little bit with this government, but we're always sort of under attack as well. When you kind of perceive that you're under attack, then you go into a reactionary mode. Well, I got to sign this. You know, every morning I open my email and there's 15 different petitions I need to sign, and they're all important, right? But I think that's an indication of me responding to the agenda of the federal government. And so I like to take a little bit of a step back and say, okay, what's important in terms of me and my family and my community and what's going on in our territory? What battles here am I going to sink myself into in the short term, and then also the long term? And I think that's important for me, to take that step back, because there's so much right now. It's very, very easy to get overwhelmed, and it's very easy to get ineffective because it's one thing after another. And I think collectively, if I had a suggestion, it's that maybe we do that and think, okay, this isn't going to change in the short term. There's going to be one thing after another. Where do we need to come out of? What's the place that we need to be in when this changes? And so for me, it's the nation, the longer term nation building work. But I don't see that being the same for everybody. And I have respect for those people who might see that differently. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Jarrett?
Yeah, I mean, you know, being put in a war that you didn't choose, with the attacks coming from all sides, I mean, it absolutely puts you in a position where you are constantly in a reactionary mode. The unfortunate part of that is that then the thinking tends to start being defensive, and that can often lead to a lot of missteps, because we have to think in such short-term, with such short-term kind of perspective. And I think that pulling back is actually really important. Pulling back, not in the sense of retreat from the pressing issues that need to be dealt with, but being able to maintain a bit of a longer view. For me, I mean, I've been thinking a lot just about how few in numbers, in a lot of ways, members of our communities are, and how spread out we are, just in the geography of Canada, let alone across Turtle Island, let alone further beyond that, and how there's this necessity in the current moment to connect those few people that are in these different communities in order that we can kind of build some more kind of collective power. And I feel like that's really, really what's going forward. We need to put the few in numbers in better contact so that we can address the crises as they come.
I was saying, like, you know, one of the people say, like, oh, we get into a defensive mode. But I think there's a difference between, like, defensive and reactionary. Like, you could be defensive and still kind of be controlling the agenda in a sense. And also one of the key tenets of defense is, like, how do you undermine your opponent's capacity to attack? Mm. Like, that's one of the key principles of defending something. And, like, so, you know, dialogue, speaking in terms of, like, conversation and dialogue, of course, it's like, how do you take the power away from these people who've clearly abused it in these kinds of ways? Or, you know, organize in a way with that, at least with that principle in mind, because once you're responding to whatever they throw, it's often too late at that point.
Yeah, and one of the main sort of frameworks that Indigenous Nationhood Movement has is rename, reclaim, reoccupy, and that's something I think a lot of us think about a lot constantly, probably. But in terms of, you know, governance and governments and sovereignty, you know, when I think about El Sipoktuk and the injunction and the fact that this is unceded territory. And I think about that injunction. I've kind of been obsessed with it. Like, how is it that this judge is making a decision that has already been made on unceded territory? And so how do we realize that? How do we assert that? You know, how do we assert that? No, we're not asking your permission. We're telling you this. We're saying no here in this space. I mean, that's something I think a lot of us are problematizing. You know, how do we do that?
I think a lot of the inspiring actions that I've seen around renaming are communities getting together and then renaming either streets in downtown Toronto with Anishinaabemowin, mm-hmm. or our mountains in Victoria with Bacall's, or even in El Sipoktuk when those families went out on the land and claimed the territory as theirs. And I think that over the long term, projects like that are very empowering and inspiring internally, because we're living aligned with our own stories and our own history and our own values. But they also bring in other people outside of our communities, and that assertion of sovereignty and nationhood is there. So they also have this education project, and they're the kinds of actions that come they're not reactions. Their actual actions that are grounded in Indigenous political traditions and our own history. And I think that flips it a little bit, but it flips it in an important way.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would also just add to that with the Bacall's renaming, for example, that was something that had been called for within the community by elders for a long time. And so that was acting on a call that was internal to the nation that had been something that was ongoing. And I think that it depends really on who we're listening to and where we're taking direction from. And so not everything has to come based on legislation or based on action from the federal government. A lot of the actions that need to be taken are internal to our own systems of governance, and we need to look there.
Hello? Jared? Oh, I think he just lost his connection there. Jared, are you there? Oh. Yes, as Jarrett was saying, taking direction from the community is definitely essential to indigenizing or you know, reclaiming that space and renaming space.
And imagine if that community had got a petition and asked for permission and gone sort of that other route, they would still be arguing with probably city councilors about the name change. So right. I think that smart, strategic, intelligent actions that aren't reactions are really important in all of this work.
Yeah, definitely. And inspire, I think, to and empower in other ways as
yeah.
well, right? Which is essential. And then, of course, one thing we didn't get into, but I'll just say it, is educating mm-hmm. non-Indigenous people the whole story of the history here, and not just the Eurocentric version that yeah. we all too often hear. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, Jarrett, are you there? No.
I
oh, you're
I'm
there.
Here.
He's back.
We lost you for a second. Do you want to finish your thought there before we sign off?
No, but I just heard you say the point about education, and I would say that that responsibility is on all of us. And I feel like if everybody did that work around educating themselves, both about the histories of colonialism, but also about what we've been talking about today, the histories of our interconnections, the histories of our co-resistance and our struggle. If we all do that work of educating ourselves, we're empowering ourselves to make these kind of more active, self-determining decisions for the future.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, on that note, I want to thank you both. I want to say Nyawangoa to you both for taking the time to speak with us today, and Leanne for coming in. It's been an honor having you on the show.
Namikwich, it was a great conversation.
And Nyawan, to you both for the work that you've done on the Nations Rising website and all of your work. Leanne, you've got a book out. I'm just trying to look it up right now. But if people are interested in finding out more, they should go to leannesimpson.ca and they can order it there. And you're in town tonight for a CD launch.
I'm in town for Tara Williamson's new LP. She's a singer-songwriter from Peterborough of Anishinaabeg and Cree ancestry, originally from Manitoba. And this is her first album, and it's going to be amazing. It's at the Monarch at 9 p.m.
That's awesome. And your book, your latest book, is Stories and Songs, Islands of Decolonial Love.
Yes.
I love that title. That's an awesome title. And if people want to purchase that or find out more about you, once again, it's leannesimpson.ca. And then Indigenous Nationhood Movement website is nationsrising.org. If people want to get in touch with you, Jarrett, what should they do?
They can get in touch with any of us and all of us through the Nations Rising site. All the info is up there. And I would really encourage people, especially with the blog, to go and read all the different voices and stories and words that people have been sharing. There's a lot of really, really good information and a lot of good perspective there.
Yeah, I mean, just so many contributors. Jeff Korntassel, Tayo Gyalfred, Siku Alulo. The list goes on and on and on. Some really incredible pieces on that website. I've just been eating it up as over the last 3 weeks. It's been really great. So once again, Nyawan, to both of you for joining us. And to the listeners, you're listening to The Vibe Collective on CIUT. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have these roundtable talks. We talk about things like social justice, decolonization,
love, parenthood, resistance,
gossip.
That's Adrian's favorite topic. And shout out to Kemba King, Luam Kidani, and Melinda, a.k.a. DocuVixen. We are all The Vibe Collective. If you want to know more about us, check out our website at thevibecollective.wordpress.com. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, the DJs will bring you music to move you here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Did you know you can listen to CIUT 5 different ways? Online, on satellite TV, digital cable, on FM radio, and on the go. Find CIUT online at iTunes Radio under Campus University, or go to the live stream at www.ciut.fm. You can also locate us on satellite at Star Choice Channel 826, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, and Bell 5 Channel 970. Listen to us on the go with TuneIn Radio's free app. And don't forget, we're on the FM dial at 89.5 FM. Spread the word. The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5 FM.